There is a word in Spanish that sounds almost like nothing. Perejil. It means parsley, a kitchen herb used in soup and sauce. Something you crush into a pot without a second thought. In October of 1937, on the northwestern border of the Dominican Republic, that word became a death sentence. The men who came at night were soldiers and militiamen acting under orders from Rafael Leonidas Trujillo, who had ruled the Dominican Republic with absolute power since 1930. They moved through the border villages while families slept, through the dark towns of Dajabon, Monte Cristi, and the scattered agricultural settlements between them. They were not looking for criminals. They were not responding to acts of violence. They were executing a racial policy, and they needed a way to tell the difference, quickly, in the dark, between Dominican workers and Haitian ones. The test they used was a parsley stem held in front of a man's face. Say this word, perejil. The Spanish letter R requires a rolling trill made with the tip of the tongue against the roof of the mouth, a sound produced deep in the throat, Haitian Creole, shaped by centuries of French phonology and its own distinct vocal architecture, does not produce this sound the same way. If a man could not roll that R, he was Haitian. And if he was Haitian, he died. This event is called the Parsley Massacre in English. In Haitian communities along the border, it has long been known as El Corte, the cutting. That name refers to the primary weapon used, the machete, not the rifle. Trujillo's soldiers and the armed civilian groups that accompanied them were instructed to use blades rather than firearms wherever possible. The reason was deliberate and political. Deaths by machete in the context of a rural border region could be attributed to civilian conflict between farmers. Deaths by military rifle could not. Trujillo was calculating how the evidence would read once the killing was over, and he had decided that the evidence should be ambiguous. The estimates of the dead range from 15,000 to 30,000 people. No precise number has ever been established, and none ever will be. Trujillo's government suppressed, and in many cases destroyed, records of what was happening during those 8 days. Bodies were thrown into the Massacre River, the waterway that crosses the border between the Dominican town of Dajabon and the Haitian town of Guanaminthe. That river had already carried its name from a different killing, an 18th-century slaughter of French buccaneers on its banks, and in October 1937 it earned the name again. Bodies were also taken to the ocean and disposed of there, carried beyond recovery by the currents of the Atlantic. Every number researchers have worked with since that time carries a caveat. We are estimating. The uncertainty is not a failure of scholarship. It is the record of a government's deliberate effort to make its victims uncountable. To understand how October 1937 was possible, you have to understand what Trujillo had been constructing for the 7 years before it. His political project rested on a racial and cultural ideology that historians call anti-Haitianismo, a systematic positioning of Dominican identity against Haitian identity, which in Trujillo's framework meant positioning light-skinned Hispanic culture against black African culture. He promoted this ideology through state media, through school curricula, through the language of national pride. He had, by some accounts, mixed ancestry himself, and was darker than his official photographs suggested, photographs in which his skin was lightened, his European features emphasized. He cultivated the appearance of European legitimacy and built a mythology of Dominican civilization that depended on contrast with Haiti. He encouraged immigration from Spain. He built statues of Christopher Columbus. He spoke often of the threat posed by Haitian infiltration to Dominican racial purity, a phrase that would have felt at home in the fascist literature circulating in Europe during the same decade. The Haitian presence in the Dominican border region had grown substantially through the early 20th century. American sugar corporations, which had established large plantation operations in the Dominican Republic during the United States military occupation that lasted from 1916 to 1924, had actively recruited Haitian laborers to work the cane harvest. These workers settled in border communities, built lives, raised children who were born on Dominican soil and who knew no other home. By the 1930s, the border region held a complex mixed population of people who moved between languages and communities, who intermarried, who shared markets and fields, and the ordinary texture of daily life. Trujillo looked at this population and saw a demographic threat to his project of national whitening. In public speeches in the months before October, he announced that Haitian migrants were stealing Dominican cattle and disrupting the agricultural economy of the border provinces. The evidence for systematic Haitian theft was never clearly established. It was a political framing, a way of attaching a concrete grievance to a population he had already decided to remove. What the historical record shows is that Trujillo toured the northern border province in August of 1937 and delivered speeches that historians have since read as a preparation of the ground, language that framed Haitian workers not as laborers or neighbors, but as an invasion force, whose presence was incompatible with Dominican life. The killing began on the night of October 2nd. It lasted approximately 8 days, concentrated in the northern and northwestern border provinces. In some towns, soldiers arrived at dusk and worked through the night. In others, the violence continued through the day, visible to anyone in the street. The Parsley test was administered at border checkpoints, on roads, and at front doors. In communities where the Haitian population was well known to local military commanders, the test was sometimes bypassed entirely, and identification was made on appearance alone. A man's skin, his hair, the language he called out to a neighbor as the soldiers approached, these were sufficient. Not every Dominican participated. Documented testimony collected by researchers, including interviews conducted with people who had been children in the border region in 1937 and who were still alive when scholars began gathering accounts decades later, describes Dominican families who hid their Haitian workers in root cellars, in irrigation channels, under floors. There were people who walked to a neighbor's house in the hour before the soldiers arrived to give warning. There were people who told soldiers that a Haitian worker was Dominican when questioned, who lied quietly and steadily in the face of armed men because the lie was the human thing to do. These acts of protection did not stop the massacre. They exist in the record anyway, and they matter. Mass violence is never the unanimous expression of a people. It is organized from above, and it always encounters resistance from below, even when that resistance is small, quiet, and invisible from a distance. The international response was restrained and inadequate. The United States government, whose sugar companies had helped create the labor migration that brought Haitian workers to the Dominican border region in the first place, expressed formal diplomatic concern and took no significant action. Trujillo was a valued partner in the Caribbean, predictable, cooperative with American commercial interests, and reliably hostile to communism. The State Department's cables from the period are careful documents. They describe concern. They do not describe consequences. Haiti's government entered negotiations with Trujillo in the weeks after the killing ended. Haiti was politically fragile and economically dependent on the stability of the island relationship. The settlement reached in January 1938 required the Dominican Republic to pay $750,000 to Haiti as reparations. After further negotiation, the amount actually paid was reduced to $525,000. Divided across the lower bound estimate of 15,000 deaths, that sum amounts to approximately $35 per person. The matter was formally closed. No Dominican official faced criminal proceedings. No international court convened. Trujillo issued a statement in which he did not acknowledge what had been done. The diplomats returned to their work, and the killing was filed away under the heading of Caribbean border relations. Trujillo himself continued to govern for another 24 years. He was shot dead in an ambush on a highway outside Santo Domingo in May of 1961, killed by conspirators that included officers from within his own military apparatus. He had governed for 31 years, maintained active relationships with the United States throughout, and died having never been made to answer in any formal setting for what he ordered in October 1937. What survived was memory, carried by those who fled. The Haitian communities of the border region preserved the story of El Corte in oral tradition, in testimonies passed between generations, in the particular gravity that certain weeks in October carry in some families near the frontier. Edwidge Dantegat, the Haitian-American novelist, published The Farming of Bones in 1998. The novel follows a Haitian sugar worker through the days of the massacre, the terror of the Parsley test, the river crossing, the long work of surviving a thing that should not have to be survived. It was the first major literary work in English to center the massacre as its subject, and it brought the event to an audience that had largely never encountered this history. It won the American Book Award and became in time a standard text in Caribbean history education. The mystery thread that historians return to is the question of command. The evidence clearly positions Trujillo as the organizing force behind El Corte. What is harder to establish with precision is the exact chain of command in each village, each hour of each of the 8 days. Some scholars argue the operation was tightly coordinated from the center. Others suggest that Trujillo established the ideological permission and the broad directive, and that regional commanders and civilian militiamen executed it with varying degrees of improvisation and local initiative. The distinction matters for any legal framework that might have been applied, had one existed. But no legal framework was ever applied. The dispersal of responsibility across dozens of locations and hundreds of actors was, whether intentional or not, one of the mechanisms by which the killing survived its own historical examination. The line between what can be proved and what can only be inferred runs through October 1937 the way the Massacre River runs through the border, carrying memory in both directions, settling into silt, never fully clear at the bottom. The legacy of the massacre did not stay locked in the 1930s. In 2013, the Constitutional Court of the Dominican Republic issued ruling TC-016813, which retroactively stripped Dominican citizenship from anyone who could not document Dominican-born ancestry going back multiple generations. The ruling affected an estimated 200,000 people, most of Haitian descent, many of whom had been born on Dominican soil, some whose families had been there for 3 and 4 generations. The Inter-American Court of Human Rights challenged it. International human rights organizations condemned it. The Dominican government defended it in terms that would have been recognizable to anyone familiar with Trujillo's ideological framework, language of demographic protection, national identity, and cultural preservation, updated for the vocabulary of constitutional law. The ruling was partially modified in its implementation, but never reversed. Tens of thousands of people affected by it remain in legal uncertainty as of the mid-2020s. Stateless on an island, their families have known their entire lives. Perigio. 3 syllables. A sound that the human throat can or cannot produce depending on which language shaped it first, which phonology was absorbed in childhood, which sounds were never trained into the muscle and the breath. In 1937, on a dark road in the borderlands, that sound was demanded of a man who had spent his working life in the Dominican sugar fields and who could not, under pressure, with a blade within reach, produce the roll of the R that the soldiers required. What followed is not recorded in any document. It was not meant to be. A kitchen herb, an ordinary word, something you buy at the market without thinking, and in the right place, in the right decade, under the right ideology, it was worth everything.